The Nile Delta in Egypt is fan-shaped, and at the left-hand corner of the front of the fan, as it were, is a small town called Rosetta. This town is famous because in 1799 the French found at that town a stone about 3 foot in length of black basalt which contained an inscription upon it which was dated approximately 200 years B.C. The important point, however, was that upon this stone were not only the hieroglyphics, the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics, expressing the writing, but there was also a translation in the Demotic tongue and another in Greek characters. This stone, therefore, made possible the translation of the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphic writings, which up to that time had been indecipherable and untranslatable, not necessarily indecipherable, to the students of the ancient Egyptian teachings and to archaeologists. With the unlocking of the door to the ancient Egyptian writings, there was understood all the foundations of most of the religions of the Near East and the Western world. That is a sweeping statement, but it is true, as you will gather as my lecture proceeds. We therefore had a picture of some of the teachings, just a small picture perhaps, of some of the teachings of the ancient Egyptians. These writings were found in the tombs of the kings and the pharaohs, mostly in the Valley of Tombs, but elsewhere throughout Egypt. Small fragments were decipherable, and therefore now translatable, upon monuments, although most of the Egyptian monuments were desecrated and damaged by the Assyrians about, 1,000 years B.C. All the statues, actually, are damaged, with the exception of a very few indeed, because the Assyrians did not agree with the idea of statues representing gods or religious or other symbology, and they smashed as many as they possibly could, and a lot of the writings were smashed with the statues. There are a few extracts from these writings on tablets of various types, and from these have been written up, have been gathered together, sifted and edited, what remains of the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which is of course the description of the afterlife as the Egyptians knew it. Some fragments of other documents remain, giving us some of the history of the various pharaohs and of the activities of the Egyptian people. But although this door was unlocked, much of that which was discovered, that even which has been translated by students, is apparently meaningless. And this is because the writings on many of these Egyptian tombs and other tablets express the ideas that were taught in the mystery schools. They are, therefore, only to be fully understood by those who have the key to the mystery school's teaching or some occult knowledge of the ancient wisdom. They are, in many cases, clothed in symbols, which in those days were only understood by those initiated into the mysteries, and today are understood best by those who have some knowledge of the ancient wisdom. The mysteries of Egypt and Greece were not secret societies. They became secret societies in Rome first, and then in early Christian times, and following that in the Middle Ages, and until recently, they were still taught in secret societies, Rosicrucian and other societies. In those days, all people knew about the mysteries, and they understood and appreciated the authority of those who were leaders in the mysteries and who were nearly always also leaders in political and social life. These men were first of all the pharaohs, the kings of Egypt, who were spiritual kings in a sense in that possibly does not apply to most kings in the world today. They were initiates, in nearly every case, into the mysteries. Then there were the nomarch, those heads, as it were, of counties or districts, who were in turn heads of the mysteries in their particular district. And all the Greek leaders, the priests and the social leaders, were nearly always also initiates of the mysteries. It was the Romans who started the persecution in the Mithraic mysteries and following them, when the mysteries themselves were forced underground. The mysteries that everyone knew about were termed the lesser mysteries, and they concerned mostly a preparation for the life after death, and some of the facts about the conditions one encounters after passing out of the physical world. They were great public institutions, centers of national culture, centers of artistic culture in many cases, and they were, of course, the center of the religious life of the people. And people of all classes flocked in thousands to the great ceremonial meetings and activities, and thousands were members of the lesser mysteries. The cultured man had there, as well as an understanding of the troubles and of this life and the principles, the moral principles which he should work to, he had as well a vivid realization of the future of life after death, of man's place in the scheme of things, and therefore he had an understanding of that which was worth doing and that which was worth living for. These cultured people belonged to the lesser mysteries. And their teaching was clothed in symbols, much of which today remains also clothed in symbols in Egypt, in the hieroglyphics themselves, and in what few myths and legends remain to us, and in Greece most definitely in the myths and legends of that ancient country as they have been preserved and brought down to us by classical writers. Some of these members of the lesser mysteries were interested, were diligent, and had high ideals, and passed, therefore, into the greater mysteries, where vows of secrecy were required. And therefore, very little was written down, and very little remains of the teachings of those inner mysteries. I said earlier the finding of those translations unlocked the door to the foundations of the great religions, of nearly all the great religions of the Western world and the Near East. They also unlocked the door to the basis of Western religious beliefs and culture, which is, of course, ethical in its nature. They were linked or followed by the religious systems of the Assyrians, of the Jews, in the early Semitic writings, and with the Jews, all those sects which are so important in our study of the early Christian origins, including the Essenes and others in Palestine at a later date. They were passed, I'm talking about the secrets of the Egyptian mysteries, they were passed to the Greeks and formed the basis of most of the activities that come under the heading of the Greek mysteries. There was undoubtedly many stages of Egyptian history, contact with India, and there is an akinship between the teachings of the greater mysteries and the great Vedas and the Upanishads of ancient India. The source of both is probably the same, and as ancient as the world, and as sacred as the world, and as all-embracing as the history of the whole world. I've been to Luxor, and I've been to Karnak, and you see there the remains of buildings, some of which are probably nearly 100,000 years old. The air at Luxor is absolutely dry. It rains very seldom. It is clear and it is pure because it blows across the deserts. It therefore does not contain the moisture or impurities necessary for the deterioration of stone. And the lasting qualities of the Egyptian buildings are such that they are today much what they were in those days. That's not quite the case down in Lower Egypt, because you do get more rain at Cairo, and the pyramids themselves have been affected by weather. Now, when I say 100,000 years ago, I am basing my calculations on the occult records which say that the Atlanteans, those fourth root race people whose empire flourished in a land that now lies beneath the sea off the Atlantic coast of South America, and whose civilization was of the highest quality, this record states that these Atlanteans conquered Egypt about 150,000 years ago, and their empire, the first great Egyptian empire, lasted for 75,000 years from that date. Now, not all the buildings in Karnak, and certainly not those in Luxor, all belong to this period. Most of them, as is the case in the ancient world, are rebuilt upon the ancient site of the earlier buildings. At about 75,000 years ago, part of the continent of Atlantis sank, the two main islands leaving only Posidonis. And the flood which followed swept across the low-lying Egyptian land and destroyed the people, but did not necessarily completely destroy their buildings and other monuments. It is said at that time that the tops of the pyramids were visible above the sea. Now, it's interesting that there are three pyramids. I climbed one, and I now realize I climbed the wrong one. I climbed the one which was easiest. The steps weren't so high. But had I climbed the one that has the alabaster top to it, I may have been able to find some verification for this statement. Because, you know, all those pyramids at one time were sheathed in shining white alabaster. And there is one pyramid today, the top quarter, or perhaps sixth of which, is still covered with white alabaster. And that alabaster stops at a line which could have been high tide level at that time. Fantastic as these ideas may seem, there is strong evidence that the pyramids are hundreds of thousands of years old. There is evidence, I'm digressing now, but it's very interesting, there is evidence because they are orientated exactly to face in a certain direction. They stand at the 30th parallel of latitude and approximately the 30th parallel of longitude. And that orientation is based upon the position, I understand, of a star, which I think is Polaris, at a certain time in the Earth's history. Now, the axis of the Earth, I'm speaking from memory now, we understand, slightly in motion, in movement. And that shaft does not now point in the direction which it originally did. And were it, and it has been calculated, traced back, it would prove the age to be in the region of 100,000 years. Much has been written about this subject with exact calculation of dimensions, angles, and many other things. It doesn't really come in the scope of my lecture tonight. After the flood, when the swamps became habitable, a Negroid race came up from Lower Africa, and this Negroid race was in turn conquered by the Atlanteans, the ancient Egyptians, returning to the Upper Nile, and they reopened the temples and restored Karnak and Aswan to its former greatness. They re-established the mysteries, and this is, of course, the early ancient civilization which comes on the outer circumference of recorded history. Only the outer circumference. This empire, which reigned until the next flood, which was about 9,000 BC, this empire was ruled over by a great dynasty of divine kings. Now the spiritual welfare of the world is and always has been under the guidance of the elder brethren of humanity, the perfected men known as the Great White Brotherhood. Today they guide the world by inspiring individuals and movements towards the ideals of universal brotherhood and the realization of spiritual values, the realization that there is a spark of the divine life of God in man, and that that spark is unfolding and evolving through this life of struggle in the physical world towards spiritual perfection. In ancient Egypt, there was a center of the Great White Brotherhood, and I believe that it still exists. And therefore, there was a direct link between the life of that great civilization and the guardians of humanity. This lodge of the true mysteries, unknown as it was even to the people of that day, supervised the whole scheme of Egyptian mysteries and made them the prototype of the mysteries of all nations around. In fact, of all future mysteries for the human race. Egypt was therefore the center of spiritual illumination, which explains the reverence paid to the Egyptian mysteries by the learned Greeks of later times, especially Plotinus, Plato, Pythagoras, and many others. These adepts of the Great White Brotherhood took physical incarnation in ancient Egypt and worked among the people not only as spiritual leaders but as political and social leaders, because the two in those days were fused. The first and the greatest came to incarnation in Upper Egypt about 40,000 years B.C. He was Tahuti, or Thoth, later called by the Greeks Hermes. He cultivated and founded the cult of the Egyptian gods and restored the mysteries to the splendor of bygone days. For the history of the mysteries in Egypt has been one of fluctuations of purity and falling away towards the arts of black magic and other less spiritual ideals. Hermes, or Thoth, taught that the true light which lighteth every man who cometh into this world is Osiris, who dwells in the heart of every man. Osiris comes forth from the light. He dwells in the light. He is the light. The light is hidden everywhere, in every rock and stone. All comes forth from the light, and to the light all shall return. His instruction to the leaders of the people under him was, look for the light, follow the light. Thou art the light, let that light shine. And he said, when a man becomes one with the light, Osiris or Amun-Ra, for the two appear to be interchangeable, he becomes one with all and sees the light in everyone and in everything. It's the first object of this society. That realization is the object of all yoga, the attainment of what is called by theosophists Buddhic consciousness, the knowledge of the unity of all, and that all exists within the one all-embracing unity of God. No greater message has ever been given to the world. Osiris, the divine spirit, the god of the world today, was the first aspect of the Egyptian Trinity, not always recognized by students of Egyptology as such, but quite obviously seen by anyone who has studied the ancient wisdom and theosophical teachings. The second aspect was Isis, the eternal mother, the negative aspect of matter. And the third aspect was Horus, the sun, S-O-N, and represented the spark of the divine life in man and in manifested creation. We here see a slight difference between the Christian Trinity and that of the Egyptians. The Christian Trinity is, as you all know, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost. The Egyptian Trinity was God the Father, God the Mother, and God the Son. And those of you who have followed the story of creation in the secret doctrine will find that the Trinity of the ancient Egyptians appears to fit in better with the description given in the secret doctrine than that of the Trinity of Christian times. At least, so it seems to me. He taught that there were more than one births of Horus. He is first of all born of Isis, God born into humanity. Humanity born from virgin matter, humanity and all manifestation. Then he is born into Osiris, redeeming his mother from the long search for the fragments of her husband, scattered over the earth. And I am going later to attempt to explain the myth of Persephone, which is exactly the same as this idea of the scattering of the limbs and parts of Osiris over manifested creation and the gathering of them up again. It is in line with the story of the prodigal son in the Bible. And it was ceremonially carried out in Egypt. It was carried out, I believe, on the ceremonial lakes. And I saw one in Karnak, it still exists. And these lakes had obelisks, I think at every four corners. There was one obelisk, I remember, still left. One of them, I believe, went to London as Cleopatra's Needle and is on the embankment of the Thames to this day. I think another went to Rome, but I'm not quite sure about that. But anyway, the ceremony of the dismemberment of Osiris was carried out upon this lake as an explanation to the people that sparks of the divine life of God were, as it were, cast down into gross matter for the whole reason that after gaining experience, they would return in richer life back to the Father and, in a sense, enhance the perfection that was and always will be His. That idea of the descent of the soul into matter and of its eventual evolution back to the Godhead is, of course, the key not only to the ancient wisdom, but to all the mysteries of the world and to many of the religions of the world. There is at Karnak an entrance pylon, which I have photographs. I hadn't time to show the slides tonight, but a magnificent pylon with an archway in the true Egyptian manner, coming up like that with an entablature across the top and an opening in it. And engraved today, and not much destroyed, are the hieroglyphics which I believe still give forth that message. Let the light shine. Now Karnak and Luxor are on one side of the river. It was here that the great ceremonies took place with dancing and music through avenues of sphinxes, because the avenues of sphinxes were in the form of a square, two corners of which were on the Luxor side of the Nile, and the other two corners were on the other side, the city of the dead. Between them flowed the Nile, and many of the ceremonials were held in boats, richly decorated, and always those ceremonies had a religious significance. But it is most impressive to realize that one whole side of the river, including Thebes and the temple of Queen Hatshepsut, beautifully carved out of the rock face, was given to the city of the dead. The after-death conditions were so well understood by the ancient Egyptians that it was part of their life to understand the significance and to build temples that were intimately associated with after-death conditions. As I said before, the Book of the Dead contains descriptions of the after-death life and what was expected to be met. The Egyptians were very systematic and thorough, and they listed all those entities which might be met after death and told the initiates in the lesser mysteries how best to combat those influences when they met them in after-death conditions. Sometimes pictures were materialized, as they were later in the Greek mystery schools, and teaching of the magical formula corresponding to the mantras of India were also given. But mostly the initiate was taught to develop his will, and by training was told how to meet in this life or in any higher realm of existence all the dangers which he might encounter. I don't think I have time tonight to go into a description of the ceremonies through which the initiate went, but he was bathed, the origin of baptism, clothed in a white robe. His occult and clairvoyant faculties were tested by him being required to read the writing on the reverse side of a shield which was held to him. He was then conducted through dense underground caverns, and in the temple of Osiris in Karnak, you can see the opening in the center of the floor, underneath which is a tortuous passage, underground passage. I saw that. My fear of cobras and snakes stopped me going down and investigating it. Nothing else. He also was given the strictest and most difficult tests of various kinds. And when he came through, he was usually unconscious and was placed in a temple, and I saw one again in Karnak, a temple of Ptah, it's called. And there is an opening in the back of the temple, quite small, about 6 inches by 6 inches. And I understand that he was placed there so that the rising sun next morning at a certain time came opposite that hole and the shaft of light struck him on the face and brought him back to consciousness. And I have seen those openings. And actually, that's what the guide indicated, that that's what it was for. The guides, they have a terrible mixture of a sort of a patter, and occasionally you get some occult truths coming from them. Of course, they don't fully understand the significance. The occult truths were taught by symbols. Most of the symbols were animal in their nature. The scarab, for instance, the little beetle form, I haven't brought it with me, but an example of a very good scarab at home with incisions on the base and hieroglyphics. The scarab was taken, I understand, to symbolize the evolving self, because the scarab beetle wraps his eggs in earth, which is dense matter, rolls them into the sun, which symbolizes the divine life of Osiris, of God, and the life of the sun fertilizes the eggs, they are hatched, and the beetle, a winged beetle, emerges and rises upwards, symbolizing the freedom of the evolved life, of the life of the evolved higher self. The rebirth, as it were, of the winged beetle, the spiritual self, the higher self born from the lower nature by the light of Osiris. There are many others. One only perhaps is worth considering, that is the feather of Maat, which represents the higher principles of man. And on the walls of the Egyptian temples, you will quite often see the weighing of the feather of Maat against the soul of the departed person. All the experiences after death are sifted, and that which is of importance, that which is good from the evolving point of view of the archetypal life of the individual, is retained and built into the life of the higher self. And that is the idea symbolized by the feather of Maat. Again, one of those great truths belonging and part of the ancient wisdom as taught in so many religions. There is Sekhmet, the cat. Sekhmet, of course, represents the opposite aspect of Ptah, represents the destroyer, the Vishnu of the Hindu. And there were periods in Egyptian history where Sekhmet was worshipped and the practice of black magic was widespread. About 13,000 years BC, the Aryans from India brought their culture to Egypt. And they brought with them, by intermarriage, or I should say, they evolved by intermarriage with the existing Egyptians, a perfect physical form, which was, I believe, to form the perfect basis for the whole of the races of the Middle Eastern world. But soon after that, in terms of 3,000 or 4,000 years, Poseidonis sank and another more less great flood swept over the Sahara and it became a sea. But before that, a small band of the Egyptians who were those best trained in the mysteries and the occult knowledge had taken refuge in the mountains of Asia and were preserved. They came back to Egypt after the mystery schools and reopened the temples, But this time, at a place called Abydos, which I unfortunately could not visit, also on the Nile, but lower down than Karnak. The last period of Egyptian history is that of Menes. Mena House, the great hotel near the pyramids, is called after this. And Menes, or Manes as he's sometimes called, was a great inspired ruler, a great adept, and a great engineer. His canal system is magnificent. A great social reformer, a great leader of the people. He founded Memphis about 600 years BC. Memphis is near Cairo. It is much lower down the Nile. And then begins the historical period in Egyptian history. That the idea of reincarnation was well accepted by the Egyptians is shown by the fact that they all realized that Menes came back into incarnation successively many times after a period of only a few years in the after-death conditions, and carried on exactly the work which he had been doing as a former leader, as a former king, as a former pharaoh. That was understood and recognized by the Egyptians, and the whole life of the Egyptians during the periods of the greater workings of the mysteries, the true workings of the mysteries, was based on the idea of coming back into physical existence again. Therefore, we get the fusion of the mysteries with the government, so beautifully shown during the life of Menes. Atenaken and Queen Nefertiti are most interesting because their inner teachings, this is at a later period, the inner teachings of those two were found on tablets and are written down and can be studied. Those two broke away from the established tradition of the time and gave to the Egyptian people a religion that was very advanced indeed, one unfortunately that did not really survive. The mysteries declined during the later years and were revived only in Egypt, in the Alexandrian period, where the Egyptian was fused with the Greek and culture was based in Alexandria. Now I will pass to the Grecian mysteries, but because much that was taught in the Greek mysteries stems from the mysteries of ancient Egypt, I feel that the Egyptian mysteries are basic for the student, and in a sense the Greek are secondary. But the Greek culture, that which has come as a secondary consideration from the teachings of the Greek mysteries, is of far more importance to the Western world because it has been directly transmitted to us by the classical writings of so many Greek poets and other writers. The Greeks had a mystery tradition that is primarily their own and does not seem to have been influenced greatly by the Egyptian systems of the mysteries. I refer to the teachings of Orpheus. Although it is said that Orpheus himself was trained and initiated into the Egyptian mysteries, all that remains of the Orphic tradition are the Orphic hymns, some remnants of which have survived and have been translated. But according to occult tradition, Orpheus founded the Orphic Mysteries about 7,000 years B.C. He was, therefore, the first great adept to come to the Western world. And according to Herodotus, the great historian, he brought the mysteries from India. Anyway, his teachings were not written down. They were passed on from one generation to another by word of mouth. But later, some gold tablets were placed in the tombs of his disciples, which contained those fragments of the Orphic hymns about which I spoke. They indicate that the purpose of the Orphic mysteries was to transcend the lower nature of the personality by a life of moral purity. We again here see the Orphic tradition carried on in the work of Pythagoras at his school. This training and transcending of the lower personality was carried on during the spirit's incarnation in a series of bodies, the most dense of which is the physical body, until it was purified and released from what the Indians called the circle of births and deaths. It is said that he taught as a singer, wandering through the land, loving nature and the beauty of the mountain and the forests, that he taught those disciples who came to see him and sat at his feet, and that what he taught, which he taught them, was the ancient wisdom. Especially he taught the value of sound as a harmonizing force in the universe. Now Hermes or Thoth taught expressing God as light. Orpheus taught expressing God as sound. The teaching was the same, the methods used slightly different. Orpheus said, sound is in all things. The tiny atoms as the great stars give their tones to the divine harmony. Life is beauty, life is joy, and all creation resounds to the harmony of the creative word. If a man will but harmonize himself, then the divine harmony will manifest through him and make all nature glad. The later Greek mysteries were founded partially on the Orphic tradition and partly on the Egyptian pattern, and were influenced by those mystery schools and occult teachings which were prevalent at the time in Assyria and possibly in parts of Palestine. All the Greek teachers, as I said before, were initiated into the Egyptian mysteries. Especially we know that Plotinus was, that Plato was, and that Pythagoras was. The mystery schools of Greece were part of the national life of the people, exactly as the Egyptian mystery schools were, possibly not to quite such a great degree. But there were religious festivities, ceremonies, and there was a religious aspect to the Olympic Games and the gatherings for sports purposes. The mysteries played their part in the whole life of the people. The lesser mysteries, again, belonged to the majority of the people. I should say, perhaps, that the majority of those who contacted the mysteries entered at the level of the lesser mysteries, which were held at a place called Agrae. Their uniform, as it were, was the fawn skin with the dots, the dappled dots, on a light-colored gray-black ground, which I believe symbolized the astral body as seen clairvoyantly, because most of the teachings in the lesser mysteries in Greece were, as they were in Egypt, about the astral conditions and the life after death. They were taught vividly, sometimes by occult materialization of pictures, again similar to the Egyptian mysteries, the effects in the astral world of actions in the physical world, the working of the great law of cause and effect. As you sow, so shall you also reap. That law of action, which is known in the Eastern world as karma. And the Greek myths retain in many cases some of this occult teaching hidden in a story and are not always discernible unless you have the keys. One is Tantalus, perhaps quite well known to all of you. It is said that the person who indulges in the desires of the earthly life to any great, to too much or too great an extent, when he passes to the astral world, is surrounded by those things which he desired on earth, whether it be drink or food or what have you, but is unable to obtain the satisfaction that he did on earth, and therefore that is the idea portrayed by Tantalus, who was tantalized, that's where the word comes from, by visions of things which he could not obtain. As well as that, the evolution of man on earth was fully explained, and the idea that death is a passing to a greater life was fully believed in by all the members of the lesser mysteries. The nature of the astral world was portrayed very clearly, and we have a record of it in the underworld of the Greek mythology, with the Styx, the river of death, the passing of over, crossing of which is from the physical world to the higher worlds, with Charon the boatman, and you know, possibly most of you, the whole story. Now the greater mysteries, those held at Eleusis, dwelt mostly with the training at a higher level, that of the mind or the mental world. They studied the effect of physical and astral, that's emotional activity, upon the after-death conditions at the level of the mind. Their garment, their uniform, was the golden fleece, because that symbolized the shining golden appearance of the mental body of the developed man. And of course, that was the golden fleece that Jason went in search of and is handed down to us today in that epic poem. There was also some instruction in the ideas of evolution, in the history of the races of the world, and their evolution according to a scheme, a divine plan. There was also teaching in astronomy and the nature of the solar system, the truths of reincarnation were taught, and the descent of man voluntarily into incarnation, or shall I say, to manifestation in the material world, was also taught. In Egypt, it was taught by the dismemberment of Osiris and the gathering together of the pieces to make him whole again. In Greece, it was taught by the myth of what the teaching now remains to us in the teaching of Proserpine, or Persephone, as she is sometimes called. This is allied with another myth, that of Narcissus, the beautiful young man who, seeing his reflection in a pool of water, fell in love with it and fell into the pool and was retained, or had to stay in the pool. That is the fall of man, the myth of the fall of man, the descent of the divine life into matter, and is further explained by the myth of Proserpine, who was looking at a beautiful Narcissus when she was carried off by the king of the underworld, Pluto, down to his underworld. And she was only rescued by the efforts of her mother, Demeter, the Isis of Egyptian theology, the virgin matter, second aspect of the Logos. She was rescued with the help, I understand, of God, in that case would be Zeus. But thereafter, she had to spend half her life in the lower world and half above. She had eaten 4 pomegranate seeds. She had tasted experience in the 4 lower aspects of man's nature: the lower mental world, the astral or emotional world, the etheric world, and the dense physical world. And henceforth, she was not free. Zeus, or Jupiter, the first aspect of their trinity. Demeter, or sometimes called Pallas Athene, was the second aspect. The third I'm not quite so clear about, but there is that mystical person called Mercury who carried the caduceus, symbolizing the spiritual nature of man, in the 2 coiled forces, which represent the spiritual nature of man as it flows up the spinal column. It seems to me that that could quite easily be the third aspect of the Greek Trinity. Before I close, I should just mention, without going into detail, unfortunately, a most interesting subject, the teachings of Plato with regard to the archetypal world, the great realities at the mental level, not only on mental level as we know it, but in that which has often been called the divine mind in the world, and the reality of that divine mind of the world and its reflections into the lower worlds, which gives us the world of material existence which we know today. They were also taught in the Dionysus mysteries the reality of the importance of the playthings of Bacchus, the child Bacchus, which were the 5 Platonic solids, and from which the axes of growth of all the manifested forms in the world today are derived. Again, a whole subject in itself, but one taught in the mysteries of Greece, and one forming another core in the heart of the ancient mysteries. Then lastly, there is Pythagoras, the great teacher among teachers, who founded his school at Crotona, and later on in Italy, and who taught his disciples living with him in that school. Mathematics, but mathematics designed to describe and explain the nature of the manifested universe.